session number 18468, Reel 1.
Jack Clegg, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Manchester.
Which year was this?
1919.
Did you grow up in Manchester and have your schooling there?
Yes.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
Did you then get a job?
Not for quite some time. The period of the Depression in Manchester, jobs were not easy to come by.
But you got one eventually?
I got one eventually and worked in the cotton trade with the Calico Printers Association in Manchester until the age of 18 when I joined the Marines.
Why did you join the Marines?
Basically, the job I was in was very much a dead-end job. The pay was very, very low. And conditions in Manchester at that time were very, very poor. I had to travel between various parts of Manchester, between two main buildings, mostly on trams. And in the winter, the fogs were so thick that even the trams couldn't run. And I used to come home at night with the face completely black from the fogs that were in Manchester. And I saw an advert for the guards, as a matter of fact, and thought, well, this must be better than what I'm doing. And I went to join the guards, and on the way down, I passed the naval office and saw they were advertising for Marines, or Royal Marines. And I went in, and out of 28 that applied to join on that particular occasion, only two of us were accepted. The standards in those days were so strict that the Royal Marines would not take you if you had one tooth missing. How times changed 2 years later.
You knew what Royal Marines were?
Oh, yes. I had quite a good idea. I had a cousin who was already in the Royal Navy, and I'd had quite a chat with him many times, and he said, the life must be better aboard ship. The pay was rotten. 2 shillings a day in old money, which today is tenpence a day. Doesn't buy much when you consider that half your pay was spent on cleaning materials. I was trained at Deal, where all Marines in that area were trained, and training was very hard, as it has always been with the Royal Marines. It's always been hard training, but very thorough. We didn't do one job, we covered practically all aspects of field warfare, naval warfare, and when we passed out on the final training, I won the squad shooting medal, which was a very prized medal, and I still have now, it's a silver one, and after that, we did the naval gunnery training at Chatham and field training in Kent. And although all our equipment was the leftovers from the 1914-18 war, namely Lee Enfield rifles, Lewis guns, we considered we'd done a fairly good training, which stood us in great stead later. After completing training, I posted to the first ship, which was HMS Nelson, 45,000-ton battleship, which at that time carried probably the largest guns in the world, the 16-inch naval guns, which had to be seen to be believed, the sight of a 16-inch turret. And although I didn't actually work on the guns, I worked in the shell and cordite handling rooms, which is down the bottom of the ship. And when the guns fired, you heard no noise, just a shudder of the guns when they fired. leaving the...
How long had you signed on for?
12 years. That was the only engagement that one could join the Marines for in those days. Same as the Navy, one served for 12 years.
How did you find it aboard ship, aboard Nelson at first?
Very cramped. Very, very cramped indeed. The living quarters for the crew were very sparse. Not quite the same for the naval officers, who had quite ample accommodation, cabins, servants, wardroom, where drinks flowed freely at all times. But, as you know, the Navy was completely dry, except for the provisional tot, which was very much looked forward to. It was worth 3 pence a day in old money if you didn't take the tot. But tot was more valuable than money. If you were below the rank of petty officer or sergeant, rum was issued watered down, namely what was called two water. It's two parts water to one part rum. If you were of the rank above, petty officer and above, or sergeant and above, rum was issued neat, and it consisted 1/8 of a pint with a tot. 1/8 of a pint could lay you down for half an hour's rest if you drank it straight off, which we were supposed to do. Everybody was supposed to drink the rum. They were not supposed to keep it in any shape or form. The only rum that was allowed to be kept was for watchkeepers who were on watch, so that they could have their rum when they came off watch. But bottling rum was an offence in the Navy. But on birthdays, or if you needed a special occasion, what was called sippers. In other words, if I wanted you to take over my watch so that I could go and run ashore, you would have a sip of my tot as a reward.
But if you didn't have the tot, would you get the money?
The money, you got 3 pence a day in old money, which is 1.5 pence in new money. Yes, that was complete.
But did you take the tot?
I took the tot. It's more valuable and more useful. There's nothing worse than coming off watch. You know, a cold 4 hour watches were all 4 hours on, 4 hours off. Coming off watch, you finished your three watches for the day, you have your tot, get your head down for half an hour, it's very useful. Very warming, very comforting, because you knew that was all you were going to get that day.
Did the Marines resent the way in which the officers were treated more favourably?
I suppose to themselves, yes. Anything unfair in life is bound to cause resentment. And you had no form of protest or anything else. Yeah, that was what you joined. And that was what you got.
What did the Marines call the officers?
Oh. I don't think that's for publication. I don't think you can put that on tape.
Why not?
Well, the term in the Navy for most officers is now applied to the police. Starts with a P.
A type of farm animal, I think.
That's right.
How were you treated aboard Nelson?
Oh, under the Naval Disciplinary Act, and that was it. I mean, discipline is very, very strict on a ship, as it has to be. If you've got 1,200 men on a ship, you can't allow anything untoward to carry on.
How did the Marines get on with the seamen?
Oh, quite well. It's I think it's a fallacy to think that the Navy and the Marines were constantly at loggerheads. Obviously we were not. We had a job to do the same as they did.
What type of duties did you have aboard Nelson?
Oh, mostly watchkeeping, gunnery, and all the usual duty watches and all that sort of thing. Part of a firefighting party, or if you were for relaxation, you were part of a boat's crew, pulling boat's crew, by the way, not a sailing boat's crew. There's always great rivalry on regatta days on the Navy between the Navy and Marines and that sort of thing. Who could pull a boat faster than the other one? So the rivalry was always there.
But would you have had to deal with any law and order problem aboard ship if necessary?
Oh, yes, we were the ones that were armed. Although we didn't have access to all arms, pistols were kept on the keyboard flat and required special keys to unlock the chains. Rifles were always kept in racks and were chained. Nobody could get access to any arms without, first of all, drawing the keys from a keyboard, which was always manned by a Royal Marine sentry.
Did you have any disciplinary problems that you had to deal with aboard Nelson?
Never. No, the only disciplinary problems you ever had was a chore, if anything. Usually, when people had too much to drink, you might have to. Always, wherever you were, wherever the ship put in, there was always a naval party, probably consisting of Marines and Navy, put ashore as police. You put your own police ashore, and if there was any trouble, you just went in, called a fisting party. Always called a fisting party. And we promptly went in, hauled them out, and took them back aboard.
Did you ever do that pre-war?
Oh, yes. You're all part of the... You could be detailed. If you were duty watch, you could be detailed off to go ashore at a fisting party. Sort things out. And if the offender was too drunk, he was put in the cell for the night. And if he wasn't too drunk, he just put it back aboard and would appear before the commander the following morning, sort of thing.
Do you remember any specific incidents that you dealt with?
Not really. As I say, it was only minor trouble. People get having too much to drink, but we never had any real assault on people. Only fist fights and things like that, usually caused by drink. And they were always sorted out pretty quickly.
Did you have to punch anybody?
They never saw it happen. They very often did.
Which parts were these where you had fisting parties?
Wherever we went ashore, whatever the... Because the ships in those days used to visit all places all around Britain and Ireland and the Channel Islands, places like that, and even abroad, wherever you were in Malta or wherever, Gibraltar, that you put your own parties ashore. Although in the big naval ports like Gibraltar and Malta, there were always permanent naval patrols there, and the same as there are in England, in Portsmouth, Plymouth and Chatham. There were naval patrols from the naval barracks that used to operate. So it wasn't really necessary for you to do it in the bigger port, but it was smaller places which we used to visit around the coast. If you came in Torbay, you had to put a naval patrol ashore.
Whilst you were aboard Nelson, did you think that a war was going to break out?
No, not at the time, no. When I joined in 1937-38, I mean, nobody thought that a war would take place 20 years after what had been billed as the greatest war of all, and with the number of casualties that we'd had, no. And we certainly weren't prepared for war. At the time of the outbreak of war, I think the whole of the Marines, there were only 12,000. And that was, most of those were aboard ships.
So how did you feel when war was declared?
Surprised. At the time of the war broke out, I'd moved off HMS Nelson and joined the Mobile Naval Base Defence Organisation and was in the canal zone outside Alexandria, and we were preparing the air defences for Alexandria and the canal with the 3.7 ACAC gun, which was our latest AA weapon, and I don't think they'd even got them in England at that time.
This is the MNBDO.
MNBDO.
So what does MNBDO stand for?
Mobile Naval Base Defence Organisation.
And was this just for the Royal Marines?
Oh no, it's the Navy as well. Although the naval detachment were not with us in Egypt. They are basically the Navy's engineers. In other words, if somebody wanted a gun mounting anywhere, they could mount it with or without any specialised equipment.
Were you happy to get this job?
Yes, it was quite pleasant. We lived very rough. We lived in tents in the desert. Egypt is not a pleasant place to live in at the best of times. The conditions are pretty horrible. You have such a problem with flies and disease out there that one can't eat anything that hasn't been well washed beforehand. If you eat any fruit that can't be peeled, you can bet your life 24 hours later you're at what they call jippy tummy. You probably finish up in hospital. As I say, flies out there. People who have never seen them have no idea of how many flies can settle on your plate before you can even put it on the table.
And you were building anti-aircraft defences, yes, in Alexandria and the canals.
At Rattleton and Agamy Point. It's part of that. There's a horseshoe of Alexandria. You've got Rattleton, where the city is. Right round where the airport is Agamy Point. And, we weren't the first to be there. I think Nelson had bombarded that bit many years before.
How many skills did you need to have for this kind of work?
Well, you not only needed the skills to build the emplacements, which were built in sandbagged emplacements and pits for ammunition and that, you also had to learn how to operate the living things. Although we weren't actually going to be the people that operated the guns, you still had to make sure that the predictors, which were in those days were the earlier predictors, with the Sperry predictors and the Barenstroud rangefinders, it all had to work before we left it. So you became quite proficient at many, many trades. Not only did you become expert builders of sandbag positions and this sort of thing, and blast walls and all the rest of it, because all this was out in the open desert.
But was this laying concrete?
No concrete to lay there. No, we didn't lay any concrete at all. We had nothing to lay it with. This was all, you know, dug sandbags and sand. Hardened sand, you water sand sufficiently and roll it sufficiently, it becomes like concrete. Whether it would stand constant blast from the guns, I don't know. And as I say, we established the gun positions, and then war was declared, and it was decided that we would probably be of greater use in England than we were out in Egypt. We came back, and it was considered at that time too dangerous to come up the English Channel, so they dropped us off at Marseille, brought us across country, and we came from, I think, Cherbourg to the nearest point in England, wherever it was. And from there, I was back at Fort Cumberland, which was our depot, Fort Cumberland in Portsmouth. And I was asked if I knew anything about 3.7s. Me foolishly thinking they meant 3.7 ACAC guns, said yes. And was promptly drafted into a unit that was heading towards Scotland. And at Rosyth, we joined up with the rest of people who were coming from all over the place, and I found we were in a 3.7 howitzer unit using guns that were last used on the northwest frontier as pack guns, which were guns that could be broken down, the pieces put on mules, and then carried wherever they wanted to go. I'd had very little training on field artillery in those days, so I had to learn fast when I found that we were going to Norway as part of the expedition to repel the Germans from the Low Countries, as it was then. Germany having moved across through Denmark and was into Norway. And we went over. On the way over, we studied field gunnery. And as I say, we were very versatile. It didn't take long to learn how to work out line, range, and angle of sight. And,
this was a Royal Marine unit on these howitzers?
Yes. It was known then as the... It was named the 31st Royal Marine Howitzer Battery.
How big is a Royal Marine Howitzer Battery?
Well, at that time, I had no idea how many guns we were going to have. I had no idea how big the unit was going to be. All I knew was that I was going to be one of the gun layers on them. We had 160 HO ratings, as we called them, that were people who had been called up for the war. They'd done practically no training, had never fired a rifle, and were being sent to Norway. Eventually it was decided not to land them. So we landed only continuous service Marines. We had, I think, 6 guns, and we landed at Namsos. On the way over, I formed part of the crew of the gun that was mounted on the what was a Polish ship, the Chobry, Chobri, which subsequently was sunk off Norway. And looking through the Laos telescope as we came into up the fjord to Namsos, all I could see was what looked like a series of sticks sticking up in the air. This proved to be the chimney breast that was left of the town. The town having been firebombed, and being Norway, was built of wood. All the houses built of wood. And the only thing that remained was the chimney breast, which was built of stone. And in the centre of all this debris was one large safe, which obviously had been the local bank. On the way up, we had our first experience of what to us was a totally new weapon, the Stuka dive bomber, which none of us had ever seen or ever had any idea existed at the time. At that stage of the war, I don't think I'd seen a single wing aircraft, certainly none of our own. The only fighters we had was twin wing, Bristol Gladiators, I believe they're called. We saw none of them on the way up, but plenty of German planes which were fitted with one wing, travelling faster than anything we'd ever seen before. And the first dive bomber I saw, it came over at, which was the Stuka, it came over at about 12,500 feet, came down in a straight dive, and most people cheered it, thinking it was going to crash. And of course, at 1,250 feet, it pulled out, released the bomb, one bomb, they only carried one bomb, with a screaming device on it, which emphasised the noise as it came down, and it went straight down the funnel of a destroyer. That was our first experience of dive bombers. We'd never seen anything like it.
And were the Marines terrified by it?
I wouldn't say terrified, no. We didn't frighten too easy. I mean, we suddenly realised that here we are, we've got our 1914 equipment, which is all we've got. But we find it, we're going to have to fight a 1940 war against people who've got equipment such as this. And when we saw later the ME-109s and fighters like that and their bombers, my God, we thought... We're not going to win this one, which we didn't in Norway. We went out practically as quickly as we went in. We didn't leave the guns behind. We brought them with us. We were told to drop them in the field and said, You misunderstood us. Marines don't leave their equipment behind. We take it with us, which we did. We put them on a destroyer, and as far as I know, they were brought back to England. And then we had the job of getting back to England, which wasn't pleasant. It was 70 or 80 miles from Norway, being constantly bombed and shit. I didn't see any sea action. I didn't see any of the submarines that were supposed to be lurking out there. But we saw our poor Navy trying to, as I say, fight. They were just as handicapped as we were. I mean, the Navy had never been re-equipped since the 1914 war. Basically, what was needed was plenty of AA equipment and AA guns, which they hadn't got either. The Oerlikon was not in production in those days, which was a useful weapon for close-range work. And that old 4-inch that they were using for high-angle AA work were too slow anyway. They couldn't put enough up there to do much damage. I mean, something travelling at 300 or 400 miles an hour, you don't get many chances to hit it.
Did you fire your howitzer in Namsos?
No. The ammunition barge was blown up before it could even get ashore. So we left there with 6 howitzers and do nothing with them. So basically we're lost scores. All we've got is rifles and machine guns, such as they were.
Did you fire those?
No, only as aircraft, out of the sheer temper more than anything else, not in the hope of hitting very much.
Were the howitzers left behind?
No, they were brought back to England.
Did you have any contact with the Norwegians in Namsos?
Yes, they're very, very friendly people. And as I say, they speak better English than we did.
What was your morale like when you left Norway then?
Not too high.
Did you think that England was going to lose the war?
Well, if we take the saying that was prevalent in the country there that the war would be over by Christmas, the only proviso we could add to that was, we shan't win it. If it is over by Christmas. And of course, practically, hard on the heels of the retreat from Norway came Dunkirk.
Was there any question of you going to Dunkirk?
No, I was already on my way. I was already on my way to the Shetland Islands. I went to the Shetland Islands, picking up some more of these 37 howitzers, and went to Shetland Islands and stayed up there for 18 months. And the Shetland Islands is not a very nice place to stay.
What was wrong with it?
It's cold. There are no trees. And in that sense, it's closer to Norway than it is to England.
Weren't there any consolations living there?
None at all. The Shetland Islands in 1940 were dry. Prohibition was enforced in Norway. Mind you, we changed that.
Did you see any action whilst you were there?
From aircraft, yes. The German aircraft came over pretty often. And our Solak Akbar defence at that time for our particular battery was a twin Lewis gun. And anybody that knows twin Lewis guns knows that as soon as you start firing them, the blimmin' things jam.